Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. If it's Friday, it must be Scott Braddock. If it's Scott Braddock, it is the editor of The Quorum Report, affectionately known as the Voice of Texas, also the dean of the Austin Press Corps. So, Scott, 4 weeks, maybe it's months now, we've been talking about this secret tape. And you have been talking about it eloquently and explaining to us the backstory. But up until this week, we have not actually been able to access the tape or hear the tape. Everything changed this week. The earth shook because the tape was released. If people go to my Facebook page, both my personal Facebook page and I believe also at the Attitudes Facebook page, I linked to a story by the Texas Monthly that included both the audio of the tape as well as a transcript of the tape. I would recommend that people like sit in their car for an hour if they've got a long drive and listen. But, you know, we've talked about quid pro quo. We've talked about corruption. We've talked about what we imagine happens behind closed doors. But we've never had a front row seat with popcorn to be able to actually hear it. And it is, even the Texas Monthly said, it's almost funny in how ridiculous it is and how outrageous it is.
It seems with a lot of these scandals, Arnie, that what you end up finding out is the folks who are in power often are not all that sophisticated, are not all that clever. Yeah. When you listen to what happened, it sounds almost like a caricature of a bad guy, right? It's a window into what is the worst of what people think happens in government all the time, right? People believe that these sort of deals go on, that people say, hey, you know, if you will spend your money this way, if you will, use your influence in that way, I'll do this thing for you. And there was a court hearing on this week. The Texas Democratic Party is suing the right-wing dark money group that taped the speaker to see if there are any more tapes of him. It was referenced in the meeting that they had more than one meeting. The speaker talked about them having a breakfast meeting. He referenced that. And so they want to see if there are other recordings, if there's other communication about this. And I want to tell you about that in a minute. But one of the things the judge said was, look, anytime there's a quid pro quo, and she's handled cases like this before, it's never that a guy says, if you do this, I'll do that. It's not one sentence.
Donald Trump has taught us that. Yes.
Right. It's never that. It's a broader conversation about how this thing is going to happen over here, that thing is going to happen over there. Correct. The two statements may not seem in the conversation to be linked, but they're part of an overall theme of what's going to happen, what's going to unfold. And what the speaker says in this audio is, we had heard a lot about what was said, a lot was leaked out, ahead of time, right? Mm-hmm. Because the Stark Money Group, which has been going after, quote, establishment Republicans in Texas for decades, this group, Empower Texans, which is a dark money group, they are set up, it's deliberately confusing the way they're set up. They have a 501c3, a 501c4, and a political action committee that all have the same name, Empower Texans. So when people reference it, it's like it's under this brand. But if you're talking about the politically active nonprofits, you can't see who the contributors are. Right. If you're talking about the PAC, you can see who the contributors are because those are governed differently under campaign finance law. But these folks went after Joe Strauss for years, the former Speaker of the Texas House, saying he was a rhino, saying he was corrupt, and all this sort of stuff. And they never turned anything up. Right. And this week I was telling people it's kind of like an example of a broken clock being right maybe only once a day in this instance. They cried wolf with Joe Strauss forever, that he was some kind of corrupt actor in state government. This guy comes in, Dennis Bonin, as the successor to Strauss. People kind of thought he was going to be like a Strauss 2.0. He was on the Strauss leadership team. He was a chairman of the powerful Ways and Means Committee. Right. Last year, he rounded up enough votes to be Speaker in the House. The Speaker is elected by the members of the House, right, not the general public. Not the average voter, and so he has 149 other constituents, and those 149 are disgusted by what they heard. Basically, he said to the head of this dark money group, or actually the spokesman, or the operative for the dark money group, he said to him, if you don't spend money against me, it was very personal, it was about himself, if you don't spend money against me in my race, then we're fine. In exchange for not spending money against me, he says this to the head of a multi-million dollar PAC, if you don't spend money against me, I'll do some things for you. What would he do, Arnie? Well, this group has been trying to have influence on the floor of the Texas legislature during session for years. They've been trying to blur the line between dark money groups and media for years. They're suing in federal court. It's at the appellate level now at the Fifth Circuit in New Orleans. They're trying to get media credentials for the Texas House so that they can stand on the floor while lawmakers make, you know, do their deliberations or in the midst of their deliberations. And, you know, the easy way to explain it is, because people wonder, is that something of value for the Speaker of the House to say, I'll give you media credentials. Oh, and by the way, if that's not good enough, I'll take away the media credentials of one Scott Braddock, the editor of the Quorum Report.
Unbelievable.
I'll do all that, by the way, because they hate me, Arnie. I have been working for 6 years to expose this group for what they are.
I know.
And it kind of sounded like on the tape, you know, first of all, and we should say, the Speaker said something ugly about gay people. He said the Speaker said that one of the members of the House must be a closeted gay man. He said that his chief of staff, the Speaker's chief of staff, had joked that this Democrat from Houston, that his wife was going to be pissed when he found out that he's gay, which is ridiculous. The LGBTQ community not happy about that. The Speaker had also said that one of the female members of the Texas House is vile, and then he talked about taking away my media credential. It kind of sounded like, you know, a cheap salesman who's trying to basically say, you know, all the things that you don't like, I don't like, right? He's trying to you know, create some kind of connection with this person who, by the way, he has trashed for months, if not years. This group funded a challenger to him in his home district last year to the tune of $100,000. He doesn't want them to do that again. So as long as they won't do that again, he'll give them media credentials. They can work together. And he said this whole point of a Republican civil war, the Speaker told on this tape, told the head of the Stark Money Group, I know you guys have to do stuff in primaries. I know you have to run races and fund challengers in Republican primaries because that's your thing, that's your business, basically. So a list of 10 members of the House who are Republicans was given to the Stark Money Group in this meeting, which the Speaker publicly for months had denied happened. He said there was no list provided to this group. In the recording, the Speaker says, quote, he'll give you the list, unquote, when he's talking about the other Republicans who are with him. And you can go through the transcript, as you said, and you can just, you could highlight every line where there has just been a false statement made to the media, to members of the House, etc. And it's really the duplicity. Now, we should also say, Arnie, if people haven't kept up with this, there's a criminal investigation about this.
Yes.
Is there real quid pro quo here? Was he soliciting a bribe? We're talking about the spending of campaign cash. Two things come to mind immediately. One, they're having a meeting about how to spend campaign money in the Texas Capitol, which is not legal. You can't do that in the government building. Two, they were having that discussion during what's known as the blackout period, which is the time that Texas lawmakers are not allowed to raise or solicit campaign cash. During the session, during the legislative session, and during the veto period, there's a period after the session's over.
Wow.
In which the governor can sign or veto legislation. They're not allowed, none of the lawmakers are allowed to solicit campaign cash during that time. So the Texas Rangers, the elite investigative force of the state, is looking into this at the behest of lawmakers, and the Brazoria County District Attorney, which is the county where Bonin lives under Texas law, that's the DA with jurisdiction, they're looking into this as well. My sourcing in Brazoria County, that's the part of Texas I'm from, by the way, Wharton County, Brazoria County, the Gulf Coast, you know, down south of Houston, blue-collar area, good people down there, Arnie, and they don't deserve this. The Brazoria County DA's office looking into this.
Wow.
And why were they, and here's the other thing, why were they targeting specific Republican members of the House? What was their reason? What did they say was their reason?
Right.
In the tape, they said that their reason was that there were members who are Republicans who voted against a piece of legislation that would ban what they call taxpayer-funded lobbying. This is when cities and counties and school districts hire lobbyists to come represent their interests at the Texas Capitol, which, by the way, is absolutely necessary.
I was going to say exactly that.
The First Amendment is being trashed up one side and down the other in this meeting. I describe this guy as the Billy Bush of the tape, a guy named Dustin Burroughs, and you remember Billy Bush from
Grab Him by the Blank.
Dustin Burroughs is a Republican from Lubbock. He was in on this meeting, and there were only three of them in the meeting, the Speaker, Burroughs, and the head of the Stark Money Group. And Burroughs says, we hate cities and counties. We don't want them to have a voice at the Capitol. And look, these are the entities that are looking out for people at the local level. This is a state of nearly 30 million people spread across 254 counties and two time zones. Mm-hmm. You can't micromanage a state that big from the state capitol in Austin, particularly when the legislature only meets for 5 months every 2 years. So bill on the floor to ban that, to say that cities and counties can't hire lobbyists. It failed. It didn't pass. And there were more than 20 Republicans who voted against it. So they didn't believe that that was the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, only 10 of those no votes ended up on this list, of members that it would be okay for Empower Texans to go after. So the Republican caucus is meeting today and tomorrow. Here we're taping on Thursday.
Right.
They're meeting in Austin, and there could be a vote of no confidence in the Speaker. We'll update the story, of course, at quorumreport.com if people want to check out the very latest on this. I do want to underscore this is a developing situation, Arnie, so if people want the latest, go to quorumreport.com.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to speak sort of in broad brush away here because I know that we're not airing until Friday. But believe me, all of my sourcing right now indicates that because the Speaker was so duplicitous, because he was saying one thing in public and something completely the opposite in private, and because of who he said it to, that's the problem politically for him. He was a liar. He's a bald-faced liar. You can go through the transcript. He had said to members of the House that if they got involved in the races of other House members, if they campaigned against incumbents, be they Republicans or Democrats, that he would punish them next session if he's still the Speaker, that they would not fare well, their bills wouldn't do well, they wouldn't get good committee assignments, et cetera, if they campaigned against incumbents. Meantime, in this meeting, with the head of the shadiest group in Texas politics, he's doing the opposite. He's saying to that group, it's okay to go after these incumbents, these 10. And so then other members are wondering, should I look over my shoulder too?
Exactly.
Is the Speaker secretly plotting against me?
Exactly. Trust has been totally trashed.
Completely trashed.
Let me just read something. So I just want to reinforce a little bit of what you said, because I actually went here just before you went there. And at the Texas Monthly, let me just read like four sentences. One exchange that hasn't been reported widely concerns local elected officials, many of whom came to Austin on a bipartisan basis to oppose legislation backed by the Speaker to restrict how local governments raise and spend money. You were just saying that. Bonin calls them all idiots who are going to fare even worse next session. Listen to the threat. Quote, any mayor, county judge that was dumbass enough to come meet with me, I told them with great clarity, my goal is for this to be the worst session in the history of the legislature for cities and counties, Bonin says. Remember, this is the Speaker speaking on this tape. Burroughs chimes in, quote, I hope the
Billy
next
Bush.
Session's, Billy Bush, I hope the next session's even worse, close quote, to which Bonin replies, and I'm all for that. Apart from the facially nonsensical desire to punish local governments, the local officials in both men's districts are Republicans. It seems unlikely to go over well. And then just as sort of a point of information about our Scott Braddock that we've been talking to for almost 5 years now, everyone is expendable to Bonin and Burroughs or usable. Scott Braddock, the best sourced journalist at the Capitol, is called Sleazy by Burroughs. Bonin says he'll have Braddock banned from the floor next session at the same time as he puts Sullivan's guys on the floor, presumably because Sullivan hates him too. So all I want to say to you, Scott Braddock, is that is your obituary. That goes on your tombstone. That is the highest compliment you could ever possibly receive. And it's not just that you're the best sourced. It's who hates you identifies why you are so important. But as I posted on Facebook, I said, this is slime Texas style, but we could find slime New Hampshire style or whatever it is. The remarkable thing about this tape is that it confirms everything you kind of suspected. It confirms the influence of big money and dark money about how people are being shaken down. And as someone who served in the New Hampshire legislature for 8 years, let me tell you what it would mean to give a dark money group like Empower Texans media credentials to be on the floor. It is one thing to be able to text someone during a debate. It is another thing to be able to use your money, but to literally be there physically on the floor.
Look them in the eye while they're voting.
Exactly. Is an overreach. And not only that, but it is giving them a greater amount of influence than anyone could have possibly imagined. And what is so fascinating to me is that I believe also in the tape, is this true? Do they trash Donald Trump and say that Donald Trump is hurting the Republican Party in 2020?
The Speaker of the House mentioned some polling, if I remember right.
Yes, okay.
He mentioned some polling that said, and this was a direct quote from the Speaker, he's killing us in the suburbs. And he had polling that suggested Trump was minus 15 in some suburban communities around Texas, particularly those around Dallas-Fort Worth and Houston. And he's probably right about that, although I wonder if the president might take issue with that when he visits Texas later today or on Thursday.
If I was the Democratic Party, I would have pickup trucks with sound equipment, and I'd be playing that section over and over again as Donald Trump's motorcade arrives. I would want him to hear from. Oh my God!
Talking about that during his rally and saying, "You've got a speaker.
Exactly.
Who thinks that I'm killing. Am I killing the party? That
exactly.
The crowd would be booing. You know, forget that guy.
Well, let me. But is there a theme going on here?
There's someone for every. I will say this. In this tape, Arnie, and people should check it out.
Oh my God, it's incredible!
As you said, there's something for everyone to hate.
Exactly.
There's an anti-gay joke. There's anti-women comments. There's anti-Trump comments. There, and you listen to it, and you're just sort of you're blown away by the they basically cover the waterfront. Everything that could possibly be said to offend somebody is in there. After this guy, Dennis Bonin, portrayed himself for months to be someone who he's not. We've known him at the Capitol to be a hothead, a jerk, someone who has serious problems with his anger, who ought to be in anger management and all of that. And he, through a great PR effort, there were a lot of people who thought this guy is going to be like Joe Strauss 2.0.
Right.
He'll be a statesman. He'll be even-handed. And he was for the legislative session. Let me read to you what our publisher, Harvey Kronberg, who's been covering all this for about 35 years at the Texas Capitol, and he says, you know, I have known Dennis, this is from his column, I've known Dennis Bonin since he was elected, and that's about 25 years ago, Arnie, and always thought well of him. But this was hardball politics at its worst. He said, in a one-hour conversation, Bonin diverted the narrative from all the legislative successes that he helped engineer over 5 months and turned it into gutter politics. The headline... And my publisher tries to be a wonderful man. He's absolutely my mentor. He tries to keep things, and I think you hear this from me, tries to be dispassionate and give you just analysis, right?
Right.
This is who I learn at the feet of this man. In the headline that he himself wrote, my publisher said, Bonin tape sadly confirms duplicity and willingness to purge Republicans based on one litmus test vote. He said, criminal investigation is the least of the Speaker's problems at this point. Besides targeting Republicans, the tape confirms that as Speaker, his primary mission next session would be to silence local government.
And remember, if I hear one more time from my friends on the other side of the aisle about local control and how they genuflect to local control and the whole idea that, you know, you can't trust big government, you can't trust this, but that everything should go back to local control. And then you see these words. I mean, this is like a Saturday Night Live skit in a lot of ways. It's so bizarre. I mean, it is almost funny because it just sounds like someone wrote this script because they threw everything in. As you point out, there wasn't anyone that they didn't like harm. But let me just also say one other thing, because we've been talking to you for so long, and I go to the lieutenant governor, and the lieutenant governor was so angry, Dan Patrick, at what? at the NRA and how the NRA is actually hurting the Republican Party. And now you hear how Donald Trump is hurting the Republican Party. And in the end, it's going to be the dark money group with the tape that's hurting the Republican Party. I want the Republican Party to have a come to Jesus moment. They need it. They absolutely do. There is a theme here. And they blame everyone that has aided and abetted them. You can't blame them if you embrace them. You can't blame them if you French kissed them. You can't blame them if you took their money. You can't blame them if you hide behind them. And suddenly you realize that if you play it out, it is the most destructive thing to being able to be a party going into the future. There is a theme here, and the GOP better realize what the theme is. And the theme is them.
The theme is them, and the
theme is to
bring it full circle about these dark money groups. And how much time do we have?
We have another 5 minutes. Go on.
Okay. Well, let me say this. I wonder if people will get the message that at the root of this is the fact that we don't know who funds the group that the speaker was meeting with.
Exactly.
We don't know who
dark money
is, who is helping this guy to direct millions of dollars
right.
in Texas elections over the last however many cycles, millions of dollars to elect or defeat candidates. And here's the thing about secrecy, right? When you don't know where something's coming from, the real power is fear.
Exactly.
You're afraid.
Of everything.
Power in the corner.
Right.
To the point where the Speaker of the House, who ought to be, and this is the third most powerful elected position in the state of Texas, and he's sitting in a room fearful. What you hear on the tape is a man who's trying to do this sales job with this guy who runs this dark money group.
Right.
What you're really hearing is a guy who's afraid. He's fearful that they're going to spend money against him personally,
I know.
That they're going to try to take him out personally. They're trying to shape politics. So he's willing to sit with them and offer things that are completely inappropriate. The point being, this dark money, this secrecy, this fear leads to rot. It leads to corruption. And until you get rid of that, until you get rid of that influence, and look, Texas law, pretty straightforward in every other respect. And when it comes to campaign finance, you, in this state, you can give as much money as you want as long to a PAC as long as you disclose where it came from.
Right.
If that's not good enough for these people, I don't know what is. I know there's other places where there are limits on how much people can spend.
Right.
People can argue about that.
But not in Texas.
But not in Texas. You can give as much as you want as long as you disclose where it came from. And even Justice Scalia agreed with that.
I know.
In Citizens United and in other cases, he said, as long as you have disclosure and everyone knows where it came from, they can judge what that means.
Right.
If they don't, they can't.
It's called the power of transparency. The
power of transparency.
Exactly.
Maybe there should be caps, but at least have the transparency to say, this is where it came from. Then people can make up their minds about what those folks might want.
All right.
State government. And I'll tell you, there's a reason these people are obsessed with taking on and reining in local government. And it has to be because that's what these donors want. Who are these people?
Right. So once again, I posted another variation on this theme on my Facebook page, and I framed it this way, slime Texas style. Read the article. Listen to the tape if you have time. And when Elizabeth Warren waxes poetic about the corruption that is driving our politics, you will have some rarely heard and seen empirical data here. That's what's so amazing is the timing of this is so bad for the Republican Party, especially in Texas. I mean, you've got what's going on with Donald Trump and the impeachment. You've got what's going on with Ukraine and Syria and the Kurds and the Russians and the Turks. And even, Lindsey Graham is apoplectic because of the behavior of Donald Trump that is really putting the world at risk, not just the United States at risk. And then you have what's going on with Texas right now and what Beto did in 2018, which to show that you're on the cutting edge of potential for change. And then you see this tape, which now is a self-inflicted wound. You can't blame anyone but yourself. When you sleep with slime, guess what? You end up coming up looking like slime. And that is what is so sad here. And let me just end this way. Scott Braddock, I am a partisan. I know it. I'm a Democrat.
Sure,
but I didn't begin that way. I began because the man that invited me in to participate in the New Hampshire legislature was the Republican majority leader who had watched me work for 6 weeks in a sort of a nonpartisan way. And at the end of the 6 weeks, it was this Republican leader who said to me, you need to think about running, Arnie, because what we need in New Hampshire are people that care about our state. For the 25% that is partisan, I will fight you. But for the 75% that's what's good for our state, you need to be there. That was 1984. We need to bring back that ethic. I need to be able to value the other side, not because I agree with them, but because there's still a level of trust. And that's what this is so sad about, because it's not just about Democrats that don't trust Speaker Bonin. It is now about his own people. And when you are a leader and you have no followers left, you are no longer a leader. And that is why Speaker Bonin must be replaced.
Yeah. Just walking alone now.
Yeah, he's the walking dead at this point. All right, Scott Braddock. It's been an honor to have you on the air for all these years. It's more of an honor to realize how you are so feared, and the reason you are feared is that you report on the truth. So,
tell the truth here, Arnie. I'm not going to stop.
I know. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's pretty funny, the reactions, by the way. One person said, you know, when all this is said and done, I'm pretty sure one of you is still going to have a job.
I'm talking to him. And on that note, when we come back, we're going to be talking with some folks from Iowa, because for some reason, Iowa seems to be really important in this 2020 campaign.
Yeah.
Don't you think so? All right, ciao. Talk to you next week, Scott. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Arnie.
All right, stick around, everyone. We'll be right back.
A tiny green insect does major damage on this current cast. Tens of millions of ash trees in the U.S. have fallen victim to an invasive insect called the emerald ash borer. That's not just a problem for forest. Trees are important for water quality.
The roots help control the nitrates and phosphates, which are some of the pollutants that can enter streams and waterways. They also hold the soil in place.
Alicia Trexler of the Western Pennsylvania Conservancy has organized numerous tree plantings in her state. She says she no longer plants ash trees at these events.
I don't want to plant food for bugs.
And she's not alone. Many communities have stopped planting ash and have begun monitoring and management efforts to try to protect existing trees. CurrentCast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future and made possible by the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds. Online at currentcast.org.
Welcome back to part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Dave Scott. So if you listen to all the pundits and all the cable news shows and all the other things, I have to admit that as a person who lives in the great state of New Hampshire, the first in the nation presidential primary, I think I'm jealous. And who am I jealous of? Iowa. Because all they keep talking about is Iowa, Iowa, Iowa. I mean, we even know that Kamala is moving to Iowa as if somehow that's going to be a way for her to rehabilitate her campaign. But I suddenly realized, you know what? We need to talk to some folks in Iowa about what's happening there. How is the political landscape? I want to remind you that Iowa is such an interesting state. It used to be more sort of, you know, blue purplish. It feels more reddish. But at the same time, I think there's a potential for it to go back to being a little more blue purplish. It is a place where you have some very powerful senators, Grassley being one of them. Actually, someone who I think was big and supportive of the whistleblower law. I think, in fact, he may have penned it. And then you also have a female senator who also is someone who's the potential to be talked to and could be listened to. But more importantly, we know that the 2020 candidates are trying to make their mark in Iowa because they need to survive there. And there are some tickets that will come out of Iowa. The question is, who will get the top five tickets? So I decided that I needed to call someone who might give us that sort of introduction to the landscape in Iowa. Sean Sebastian is joining us now. He is the Iowa Organizing Director of the Working Families Party and Movement Politics Organizer for Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement. He was formerly Director of the Fed Up campaign at the Center for Popular Democracy, organizing working class people of color to demand full employment, monetary policy at the Federal Reserve, and of course, where did he go to? He went to the University of Iowa, where, just to let you know, Sean, so did my daughter. Oh. So we have more. So I have to ask, when did you graduate?
I graduated in 2004.
2004. When did she graduate? No, I think she graduated before you. But anyway, welcome to the program. I have a close affinity to Iowa. I did have a daughter that went to the University of Iowa. I graduated from St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota, and a lot of my roommates came from Iowa. So there's always been a sense. And my first husband's family, his mother was an Iowa farm girl.
Oh, wow. So you're an honorary Iowa.
I'm an honorary, although yeah. I was born in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, but don't tell anyone. All right. So, and we've been covering Iowa politics for a long time. I've had the privilege and the honor of hanging out with Stefan Schmidt, affectionately known as Dr. Politics, from Iowa State for almost 20 years, doing presidential politics with Stefan, actually being on Iowa Public Radio for about 10 years. So I have a real sort of sense of familiarity. But this year, it feels different for a lot of reasons. It feels like the progressive voice is really in ascendance. It feels a little bit bizarre because there are so many candidates that are running that it's hard to sort of keep track of who they are. I mean, the debate the other night was, I think, in some ways almost embarrassing with 12 people on the debate stage. It wasn't really good for anyone because there were too many people, so it didn't give a sense of a debate. As someone said, it was like, you know, 12 tiny press conferences. Mm-hmm. But I'm kind of curious, as someone who is working with especially the progressive community in Iowa, tell me what you see going on there and how Donald Trump is playing out for the state as a whole, because obviously he is the backdrop to this whole conversation as we move into 2020. But how are the Democrats sort of shaking out and how are they organizing for the caucus?
Yeah, so I mean, I think you can see the polling that we have basically like a clown car of 20 different presidential candidates who are competing for a really, really small number of votes here in Iowa. In 2016, in the Iowa caucuses, 170,000 people participated. Right, you're from Bay Ridge, Brooklyn. I don't know how many blocks of Brooklyn that is. Right,
probably three. Right, exactly.
Right. And so you have 20 different campaigns, each of them, you know, to larger or smaller degrees, multi-million-dollar operations, some of them with hundreds of staff. Like you said, Kamala Harris, think about moving to Iowa to compete for those very, very few votes. And what we're seeing is what's reflected in the polling that we're all seeing, right? Like the people who are... We have Joe Biden, who has a lot of name recognition from 8 years in the White House, who came out of the gate with extremely high poll numbers that are steadily dropping. And then we have a lot of energy for the two other front runners, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, and then everyone else is at a lower tier. I'd say like maybe a middle tier with Pete Buttigieg and Kamala Harris in that tier, and then a lot of people polling at below 5%.
So let's talk a little bit about who shows up for these caucuses, because my sense is that it tends to be older adults that show up. Is that going to be – am I going to be disabused of that idea? Because what we are really seeing, in part, we saw it in 2016 with what Bernie was able to do by exciting a very different base of the Democratic Party, something that Hillary was not capable of. In 2018, we saw the delivery of that excitement because it was, you know, young people and people of color that really sort of showed up. But Iowa tends to be a little bit like New Hampshire. We're kind of old as a state itself. I don't know what you are, but I think we're the second oldest state in the nation, New Hampshire. You know, people think it's Florida, but it turns out it's actually places like Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont that are so old. And so when you look at who will actually participate in the caucus, how are these candidates organizing? And is this really the goal of making that number bigger, like you described how many people showed up for the caucus last time, or really sort of talking to a whole demographic of folks that have never thought that this was their role or their place or their caucuses was something they would do?
Yeah, so it's a great question. And like New Hampshire, Iowa does skew older and whiter, of course. But the thing with the Iowa caucuses, like that small number of 170,000 voters in 2016, also represents only 16% of the eligible people that could be participating in the caucuses, as opposed to the New Hampshire primary, which I think is around 50%.
Yeah, at least more.
Yeah, with what that means with that very, very low participation rate is that there is so much room to grow and so much room to pull in new people, young people, people of color, people who are fired up, and people who tend to be more progressive into the caucuses. And that's the core strategy of Bernie Sanders in particular, but also Elizabeth Warren as well.
When you're talking about 117,000 people, I just want, as you mentioned, I mean, these people can spend a lot of money. I mean, I'll use the example of Tom Steyer. He can spend an unlimited amount of money. I'm going to use the example of Bernie Sanders. He's sitting on $33 million. You know, Elizabeth Warren is sitting on I don't know how much money. You know, Joe Biden, unfortunately, only think has about $9 million in the bank. Boy, is he at a burn rate that would sort of blow anybody's mind. But when I'm thinking about this, and since Iowa seems to be so important, you could almost, I mean, this sounds crazy, you could almost assign a campaign staffer to every single Iowan that might, in fact, vote in or participate in the caucus. That's how tiny the participation is. That's how much money some of these candidates are. And we're talking about micromanaging through social media. If you're talking about an older demographic, they don't use social media the same way young people do. So you would physically probably – they would like someone. Don't push button one for candidate two. Don't put button two. They want to have a physical presence. But given the fact that this is so important, you could physically court individual Iowans about your candidate, which is both interesting and at some point kind of scary.
Yeah, and it's insane the amount of resources poured into so few people.
Yes.
And I should clarify, it's in 2016 it was 170,
okay.
which is still a very small number.
Yes.
But you're absolutely right, and I'll tell you, it often feels like we do have one of these canvassers or one of these organizers assigned to each one of us.
Right.
You know, I'll tell you, my parents live in Ames, Iowa, and they are turning down coffee dates with, you know, a Pete Buttigieg staffer, Elizabeth Warren staffer, like every day.
Right.
So it's still several months away from the election.
So what is the marketing message? I mean, I feel like there is this real tension, and we saw it really on the debate stage the other night. What I'm trying to figure out is that so what we see with Donald Trump is that Donald Trump has this trade war, and I understand he's sending checks to farmers, so maybe that's a way for him to deal with it. Then there was this sort of attack on ethanol, and then he realized, oh my God, I'm pissing off the farmers and we have to rehabilitate that. And then you've got climate change, which is changing the weather situation. And then you have, you know, who's going to work in your meatpacking plants? Because we're anti-immigrants. And as you and I both know, you go to a lot of the facilities in Iowa and guess what? A lot of people are probably undocumented and they need to be undocumented because nobody else wants to work there. And they're having a tough time, you know, basically get, I mean, they may do all the raids, but the raids are, if you actually talk to the people that are working there, they think that they're part of the community. They don't see them as undocumented. They see them as a neighbor. So there are so many issues going on right now. What I'm trying to figure out is, how do you package for an Iowa electorate? And what is the message that would appear to resonate that Iowans could see would make a difference in their lives? Because I keep hearing Amy Klobuchar say and Mayor Pete say, I'm from the Midwest, as if you're from a different planet. So I'm trying to figure out, what planet are you from? What do you eat for food? And what air do you drink?
Well, contrary to popular belief, contrary to what you'll read in the New York Times, we are not alien beings. We're
exactly.
humans just like everybody else.
Exactly.
And what we want is you know, be able to provide for our families, feed them, clothe them, house them, and make sure that they're healthy and have health care. And that's what everybody wants, and that's what's been denied to us over decades. We know that over the last 40 years, wages in the United States have been completely stagnant, while the 1% gets more and more money, and that's accelerated after the financial crash. In Iowa, it's particularly acute because our wages have actually been lower than the national average and lower than the Midwestern average, even lower than all of our neighbors. They've
wow.
been flat and lower.
Wow.
And then after the financial crash, we've seen this very slow and painful recovery that got us from, you know, over 10% unemployment in 2008 to where we are now, hovering at just at 3%. But in rural America, that recovery has not happened. So people are really, really hurting, and a lot of that has to do with our agriculture policy and our trade policy.
Right.
The problems in rural America did not start with Donald Trump. They are decades in the making. But Donald Trump is doing everything wrong, and you can't hide that, and you can't keep coasting on cultural issues when you are really hurting people's pocketbooks. You are messing with their livelihoods, and you are putting them in such economic peril that we have record amounts of suicides right now in Iowa because people
can't. Farmers especially. I mean, so here's a question I've never asked, and maybe you have asked the question, or maybe you should ask the question, Sean.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, so I posted on Facebook the other day after I was watching the debate, I would like each candidate on the debate stage to be asked the following questions. Have you ever lost your health insurance?
Mm-hmm.
First question. And how do you currently access health care?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So like Mayor Pete's in the veteran system. He's a vet. Okay,
yeah.
So he's got pretty good health care, you know. Maybe that may be the reason why his husband married him, because he wanted his health care. I mean, I don't know, you know. I don't know. Can you get you?
Good reason. Yeah.
Right. So here's the question I would love to ask, because we know that farmers are absolutely hurting, and I know that given the changing nature of weather. I mean, if you talk to people in Nebraska, they're still even soggy and underwater given the kind of rains that we've seen. I mean, the acute weather and the 500-year floods that are now happening every other year means that there's a climate challenge, but now there's a trade challenge. So, I mean, talk about the synergistic effect of failure. How do farmers get their health care?
It's a great question. And like one of the promises of Medicare for All is that we can actually get rural health care to rural people who have been denied it for so long. And it's not just about cost. It's about actual access, because rural hospitals are closing all over the country. So if you're a young mother who needs prenatal care,
exactly.
if you're a young mother that needs postnatal care, and you need to drive an hour, 2 hours to get it, you need to drive an hour or 2 hours to actually deliver your baby in a hospital, you're going to move out of that rural area. And actually, the closing of rural hospitals has been a major driver to the emptying of rural towns, because you know, particularly for young families, you just can't afford to put your family's health at risk, right?
Sean, we need to make this a national story. We need to interview farmers about their health care. Okay?
Yeah,
we
absolutely.
Need to go. No, and you're talking about rural hospitals. So I'm going to share a little vignette about moi. I raised my children and gave birth to my children in a little town called Orford, New Hampshire, about 1,150 people. We had no stoplight. I think we had one stop sign, okay, in the town. I had two choices to have my babies. My babies are now 37 and 35. But back then, I had two choices. I could deliver them at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center, one of the finest teaching hospitals in the country, or I could go to Cottage Hospital in Woodsville, New Hampshire, a little tiny hospital about 15 to 25 minutes away from me. I had a choice, either one. So I'll let you know, I had my babies at Cottage, not at the huge teaching hospital. And I did not have health insurance with my first baby. Okay, I did have health insurance with my second. That's a long story. But when I did have Kirsten at Cottage Hospital, here was what they were saying as they were bringing me into the delivery room. This is what you heard. Remember, this is 35 years ago. She has insurance. She has insurance. This is what they were saying in the halls of the hospital. Mm-hmm. Now, let me tell you about Cottage Hospital. They don't deliver babies anymore.
Mm.
They don't deliver. So what you are talking about, not only have I lived no insurance, not only have I lived trying to afford COBRA, but I have lived watching rural hospitals close, rural hospitals stop delivering babies because they can't afford to do it. And I just think this is a story that if you're going to be talking about the Midwest and you're talking about rural America and you're talking about farmers, this connection to healthcare is something that hasn't been promoted as loudly as it must be because farmers get it because they live that vulnerability.
Absolutely. And if you drive through rural America and rural Iowa and you stop at any gas station, what you'll find is a printed out GoFundMe page tacked up at the gas station with a little jar for to like put your change in at every gas station, because that is how people access their health care, by putting up a GoFundMe page and hoping and praying that their friends can contribute spare change. And that is not a dignified way to access the human right of health care. And I think people are absolutely ready for real health care solutions, and I think it could be something that would be a major factor in moving rural votes, which would move votes statewide, not just in Iowa, but in other places with big rural populations like Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania that we know are so important.
So during the debate, I'm so glad I'm going to be talking. I taped this show on Thursday morning, everyone. You'll hear it tomorrow on Friday. But I'm going to be talking with Bill Curry, who is a phenomenal political sort of consultant, analyst. He writes for Salon.com. He was a Democratic governor for Connecticut twice, nominee for governor. And I'm going to be talking to him about health care. And one of the questions I guess I'm going to ask you, Sebastian, because you are Sean Sebastian, is that you are in Iowa, and this is the first place where these conversations are really going to be played out. We're going to see the consequences of the ability or inability to answer the question. So when Elizabeth Warren is asked the question about how do you pay for health care, she doesn't seem to do it in a way that people feel comfortable understanding her answer. And as someone who knows how to complete a sentence, as someone who is so articulate and someone who is so precise in everything, she feels less than precise here. And of course, Bernie filled in the gaps and he said, yeah, I'm going to raise taxes. You know, I mean, I am trying to figure out, how do we make people understand you don't care what you call it? You care if you can afford it.
Mm-hmm.
So if taxes to pay for Medicare for All is 3 or 4% of my income, that's how much my taxes will go up. But the cost of my health care right now out of my pocket, or how it reduces my income, is close to 20% of what I have to pay. Would I rather pay 20% of my income and call it private insurance, or I'd rather call it taxes and pay 3% of my income? Which one would you choose? Both of them come out of my wallet. Both of them I write with a check. Both of them I have to work hard for. And both of them are something I essentially need. One is affordable, 3%, and one is unaffordable, 20%. And on top of that, the 20% means that I'm vulnerable to a private insurance company who dictates exactly how I do get it, when I get it, how many, am I in network, am I out of network, does this doctor work, does that doctor work? I mean, I feel like I'm looking at private insurance and I have my middle fingers up in stereo. And I just don't understand why we are so afraid of using the tax word when we really should look at the word saying, what are you paying and what are you getting? And if you call it a tax or you call it a premium or a deductible or whatever, does it matter? If you can't afford it and you don't get the result, why are you holding on to it?
Absolutely. And I mean, the fear around this is the result of, you know, like a decades-long propaganda effort that demonizes taxes that has been perpetuated by the right. And so people are afraid of kind of talking about this and having that video cut up out of context and, you know, a commercial being made that this person's going to raise your taxes, when in fact almost everyone but the richest of the rich, the highest income people, will be paying less out of their pocket, exactly how you said, right? This money goes out of your pocket, whether it goes to a private insurance company who's denying you care or to the government that will guarantee you care, that will make sure that you get all the care that you need, and that will give you the choice of choosing a doctor, not just limiting your choice to the in-network people that the private insurance company dictates.
I've known Bernie for 40 years. I don't know Elizabeth, but I've known Bernie for a long time. And what I love about it is that Bernie's not afraid to use the word taxes because then he explains it.
Yeah.
And if you run away from it from the very beginning, you never get a chance to explain it.
Mm.
And if you don't get a chance to explain it, you don't get to use the power of its equity, of its justice, of its result. And that's the part that absolutely kills me. I mean, you know you can't repair your roads by yourself.
Yeah.
And you know that a private company ain't going to come in and repair your roads. You know the only way you're going to repair your highways is if you do it collectively. And the way to do it collectively is through taxes. And in a bizarre way, health insurance is not a highway, but health care is a highway.
Yeah.
And that's what you want to do, is you want to fund the highway to health. You don't want to fund the pothole in front of your house, because just because your pothole is filled, if the rest of the road sucks, you lose an axle. You know, I mean, it's I want people to begin to put it into terms and take back the words. And I don't know what happens in Iowa, but Iowa's got to be the first place where we reestablish and redefine terms so that candidates are liberated to be able to do the math for people. Because what I saw with Elizabeth broke my heart, because in a way, she's caving to what they've defined as what is right and what is wrong, and they are wrong.
And I'd just like to say one thing here. I mean, I agree with everything that you just said. Also, the fact is that, you know, in the Des Moines Register in March did a poll of likely Democratic caucus goers, and 85% of people approve of Medicare for All. 85% of likely Democratic caucus goers want Medicare for All. It is the overwhelming consensus. And of course, now we have millions of dollars that the healthcare industry is pouring into our airwaves from the partnership, from something called the Partnership for America's Healthcare Future,
yes,
which is all these private hospitals, all these private health insurance companies pouring in this money for disinformation. Every time you open YouTube in Iowa, you're going to see a commercial that is spreading these lies.
Exactly.
And, you know, by the way, people like Mayor Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar are repeating those lies from those industry lobbyists in debates. But it's all geared at the fact that there is an overwhelming common sense consensus among the Democratic electorate that we want Medicare for All, and that's what's scaring the industry, and that's why it's our job at Iowa CCI to bring people together, educate them, and take all of us whose lives depend on healthcare and whose lives depend on Medicare for All, and educate each other and, like, fight these corporations that are lying to us so they can keep a profit and they can kill us in the process.
I want to remind everyone, you've heard me say it, I gave a speech to, we had a party like a progressive on Saturday, and I reminded everyone at the beginning of my talk, I said, just remember, health insurance is not health care. Let me remind you, they have bludgeoned you into thinking that health insurance is health care. It ain't. It ain't. And I also want to remind everyone that when you turn age 65, do you lament, oh my God, I may have to give up my private insurance and go on Medicare? No, I wanted to be 65 30 years ago. I mean, that's what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
I didn't want to have to wait till I'm 65. So, Sean, before I let you go, this is great. I'm so excited. But more importantly, I want to ask the question, when they do the polling, and you said that, you know, 80% or 85% of the Democrats or even support this idea of Medicare for All, what my question is, do they care whether it happens in 4 years or 6 years or 8 years? And the reason I ask that is I look at Canada, and Canada did not embrace their Canadian healthcare system as a country. They went province by province by province.
Mm.
They experimented. They worked out the kinks. And then as a nation, they embraced it. If you look at the models in Germany and France and England and Switzerland, they're all different, but they all do it better. Some of them even have private insurance, except it ain't private. It's nonprofit and highly regulated. Let me remind you, highly regulated. So I'm just sort of curious. We need to do another poll, because I want, you know, Bernie says I'll do it in 4 years. What I want to make sure is that we get to goal. I want to make sure that we can work out the kinks. Would you be offended if it was a 6-year plan or an 8-year plan, or we experimented in California or we experimented in New England? But ultimately, if this is where we want to go, we need to be able to have the leadership to get there. Is the 4-year the litmus test, or is the litmus test that we're going to get to goal and it's going to happen in my lifetime, gosh darn it, and it's not going to be that because insurance companies have dictated the Affordable Care Act and Big Pharma dictated the terms of the Affordable Care Act, that they're going to dictate the terms of future health care. Future health care are going to be dictated by needs and by health.
So I'll say that that Des Moines Register poll is a combination of people who say they want Medicare for All now and also people who want Medicare for All in steps.
Okay,
so it incorporates
perfect.
Both of those people.
Thank
but
you.
I will say time is of the essence. People's lives are on the line, and every day people are dying because they can't afford health care. So, you know, I want to get to the promised land as quickly as possible because every day people's lives are on the line.
So someone once called me that I was the progressive Moses in New Hampshire, and I started to cry. No, I started to cry, Sean Sebastian, because Moses never got to the promised land. And on that note, thank
You're
you so
Aaron.
Yeah, I love you, Sean.
Barney and Aaron.
Yeah, Sean Sebastian is the Iowa Organizing Director of Working Families Party and Movement Politics Organizer for Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement. Sean, we got to hang out more often. Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate
thank
it.
You.
All right, this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. We will see you next week.
Okay, bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.